Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Good morning and welcome to the Morning Briefing for Monday, May 21st, 2018. I'm your host, Eric Dame. Jake Hughes is your producer. And coming up on today's show, we're going to speak to Melissa Bryant from IAVA and get their thoughts on all the big things that have been happening in the veteran community, legislatively and otherwise, here in Washington, D.C., including the nomination of Robert Wilkie for Secretary of the VA. We'll find out what the newest of the big VSOs on the block has to say about that, the Mission Act, burn pit legislation, and so much more. We're also going to talk to Chris White. Chris is the founder of Freedom Hard. Now, Freedom Hard, they're not just another military t-shirt company. No. They're also not just another military coffee company. Oh, no. They're also not just another military cigar company. In fact, they're all three of those things and more. We're going to talk to Chris about where he got the idea for his company, how he developed this wide-ranging brand that is Freedom Hard, and where he thinks it's going from here. But before we do any of that, it's time to welcome Jake Hughes into the studio. Good morning, Jake.
How are you? Good morning. I thought it was Jake Hughes.
Jake Hughes is your produce.
Yeah,
that's how it goes. How
are you? I'm fantastic, Eric. How are you?
I'm good. Did you have a good weekend?
Yes, I did. Saturday, I went up to Richmond to shoot a video at a gun show called Showmasters Gun Show. It was a lot of fun. Part of it was fun. Part of it was not, because it was the day after payday, and
a lot of things you wanted, didn't
you? Yeah, it's like, I look but don't touch, and it's like, I really want that M1 Garand, but it's $1,200.
Yeah. Yep, that does happen. Man, here's the thing, you know, what you want to do is get to a point where you've got enough money to buy everything that you want, and of course everything that you need. You know, first you got to cover your needs, then you can deal with the wants. I'm at the point now, my wife and I, where we get some of the things we want, but it's mostly things that we need.
Yeah,
she went to Costco the other day and had me put together a list for her of stuff that I thought we need. And I added in new TV on the list, hoping that it might sneak in there. And she'd be like, oh, okay, well, I'll grab this 78-inch flat screen and put it up on the... No, she caught it. She caught it and she didn't buy it. But what are you going to do?
Yeah, that's not the type of thing you just do accidentally, automatically. Like toilet paper, paper towels, new TV.
Where did that TV come from? I'm doing it.
Potatoes. So, you know.
Listen, I've got a credit card through that store that I get like 5% back on purchases. So really the TV's paying for itself. Let's be honest.
Yeah, totally.
Absolutely. So
Gun
shows, as someone who is a gun enthusiast, I enjoy going out to the range and shooting. I own some firearms myself. Never been to a gun show. So what is a gun show like? Because this is something, Jake, that's in the public mind. People think of gun shows as just a bunch of yahoos running around handing each other guns and doing whatever and not having any rules or regulations. What's the experience of actually going to a gun show like for those of us who've never been?
It's kind of overwhelming, because the way it works is you go in there and there are local vendors, like people who own gun shops, are there with the sign that says this is our shop, and they lay all the merchandise out there. And so you have people selling, you know, new modern firearms here, and then right next to them there'll be historic firearms. Like, I saw a genuine World War II Thompson.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was going for like $20,000.
Yeah.
Which,
that sounds about right.
Yeah, it sounds about right, exactly. And then there are people who, you know, there's also what I learned is it's not just guns. There was a guy selling knives there, and there was selling camping gear and survival equipment, and so it's all just kind of overlapping areas of interest when it comes to like survivalism and firearms and knives and things like that.
So is it kind of like going into a Cabela's or a Bass Pro Shops, except with less clothing and fishing stuff and more guns?
Yeah, the best way to describe it is it's like a flea market for guns.
Mm.
In that you have, you know, individual sellers set up their tables all over the place, and you can go and, you know, and the big thing that people need to realize is that you still have to do a background check if you buy from a vendor there.
Right. Right.
Yeah. You still, there's actually, there was a booth there that offered like $50 background checks. But you go there, they'll do your background check for you. So you can go to the vendor and just show them the piece of paper saying, hey, I did my background check.
Right. Yeah. And those are like annotated, and those are legit background checks. The supposed gun show loophole. Remember an interview I did on a previous show that I hosted up in New York with Sean Davis from The Federalist about an article that he wrote about the gun control issue and what people complain about when talking about guns. And he said the gun show loophole isn't really a thing, that, yeah, at some point there may have been some places it didn't follow the rules. But he was explaining to me how, no, you still need to do your background checks there. If people aren't following the rules, then that's a problem. But if they're not following the rules, then what difference would a law make to them if you added another one onto the books?
But you're right. Now, I will say, and I don't know any of the details on it, but there were people carrying around weapons with little signs saying they were selling them. Like, it was kind of funny. Like, the dude had a rifle slung over his shoulder with a little flag sticking out of the barrel saying, this gun is for sale. Now, I don't know how
individual sales. Like, exactly. They don't have a booth. So,
I don't know how that would work exactly, so you can't quote me.
Someone couldn't call that the gun show loophole. If it's just someone walking around, individual sales, I can sell whatever the heck I want to you, and I don't have to follow any federal regulations. Now, there are certain things that are controlled, and firearms are one of them. So I sell you a gun, that gun is traceable to me, and you use it in a crime, then I'm going to have to answer for, selling it to you and not having any paperwork showing that or anything like that. Point-to-point individual sales in any industry, though, are different than they are for
commercial sales.
Yeah, commercial sales. So the $20,000 Thompson, the Tommy gun, as it were, sounds amazing, but what did you see there? What was like the one thing that was almost like, it's probably more than I should spend, but what was there something that stuck out to you that you were like, oh, I want that, and I could probably get that. Should I get that?
There was a booth selling a used Colt 1911, still in like new condition. And it was only charging $700, which for a 1911, they usually go for over $1,000. Yeah. So looking at that, I was like, and then there were also other ones. Like, I'm big on historical firearms. Like, my dad owns an M1 carbine that I loved to shoot when I was a kid. I would love to have one like that, but they were going for about $800, which again is cheap for a historical firearm.
Yeah. Depending on, there were different, the M1 in particular was something where so many models of it were made by so many. I have one from the Plainfield, New Jersey. I can't remember the name of the company. Maybe just Plainfield Armory or something like that. But those, I looked it up not too long ago and said like, oh, this would be like $400, $350 if I bought one on the used market. They don't make them new anymore. They haven't for decades. But there are the higher quality ones that are going to be a lot more money. And it's it's a fascinating industry and a fascinating trade. And that the majority of weapons, if they're well taken care of, last for a long time.
Oh, yeah. That was a big market there, was restored historical weapons, like Springfield 1911s, M1 Garands, all these, I forget the name of it, but the rifle that was used prior to the 1911, I can't remember the name of it. But, yeah, these were restored firearms, and they were going for a lot of money because they're more collector's items than they are actual functional firearms.
Yeah. Some of them are only collector's items. Some of them are not functional firearms, right. And people will use them for decorations. I mean, they're awesome old firearms that you can use as a decoration. I know a guy I was stationed with in Italy. He got into the, is it still called the Society for Creative Anachronism when they're doing like Civil War type reenactments?
I don't know the name for it, but
Society for Creative Anachronism, as I remember it, were the people who dressed up as knights and they would attack each other and they would make their own chainmail and all that stuff. Which as a kid, I thought was kind of cool. As a teenager, I was like, what a bunch of losers. Now as an adult, I think it's kind of cool again.
So, yeah.
It goes in cycles. The people who do Civil War reenactments and things like that oftentimes use guns that are either not capable of firing at all or capable of firing blanks. That's another thing that they can do. I don't know. I don't have any decorative firearms, but I could see at some point in the future. And in the right house, they can be a really good look, like a cabin-y type place,
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the hard thing about it, because I am a firearm enthusiast. It's just I don't have the finances to fuel my hobby. So, like, I have two pistols. I have a Springfield Arms and I have a Taurus. And I used to have a shotgun, but I got rid of it. So it's like I really, really want to collect firearms. I just need a better paying job to do it.
They are not cheap. And that's one of the things, you know, that when people talk about firearms and the discussion on them, I've had many discussions on firearms because one, I kind of know what I'm talking about. And two, I tend to be fairly even keeled and don't get, you know, start screaming at people about things, even if I disagree, with very few exceptions. Like, vaccinations. If you're an anti-vaxxer, yes, I will scream at you because you need to be screamed at. You're bringing diseases that were eradicated back into the population and killing children. So yeah, I'll scream at you about that. But guns are something that I can discuss and enlighten some people on, because there are a lot of people in this country, Jake, not as many down where you're from in Texas, but up where I'm from in Connecticut, there are a lot of people who've never touched a gun. All they know about guns is what they see in movies, which is why you get politicians, national politicians. Kirsten Gillibrand from New York. I think my most popular ever tweet was a response to her when she was talking about silencers. And she was like, this will allow murderers to walk around undetected. And I'm like, no, it won't. What they do is basically lower the decibel rating a little bit. So unless they're inside of like a building with really, really thick walls, you're still going to hear it from outside. You're going to hear it from within the building. But people up there and around other parts of the country think that you put a silencer on a gun and it just goes pew. That's it.
That's, like that's what the they see in movies. Makes. Hell, they see an episode of CSI where a dude used a potato as to completely muffle the sound.
Oh yeah, that's legit. That works totally. You know, I did just see. I started watching last night a show on HBO called Barry. You heard about it?
I've heard of it. Yeah,
it's Bill Hader, who's of course Saturday Night Live, Stefan, and it was also on the amazing show Documentary Now that's still running on IFC. I think they're making a new season of that. It's about a Marine Corps veteran who struggles when he gets out and ends up becoming an assassin. Not a recommended job for of our Marines out there who are looking for work. It's a comedy show. It's him. It's Fonzie's on there. It's got Steven Root, the great character actor. They do a lot of interesting things right about his military veteran aspect, though. Like the struggle to readapt after, you know, deploying over to Afghanistan. And this guy has seen a lot of action, killed a lot of people. He ends up in the show. He's an assassin who then gets bit by the acting bug. And I'm not giving anything away. It's very early on. It was in all the ads for the show. Then at one point, they start talking about the morality of killing people. And he starts screaming at the people. They're like, so what does that make me, a monster? Because I've killed people. I've done it before. And I was following orders, just like Macbeth was. It's in the context of the play Macbeth that they're talking about it. They do a lot of things right. He goes to a party and one of his old Marine buddies comes along and brings a couple other Marines, and they end up like slapping and headbutting each other in the kitchen, doing things that Marines often do. That was accurate as well. One of the things that they get wrong, though, is the firearms, where it's like, you know, just pew, pew. He's walking up to a truck where he's supposed to kill a guy. Like, that's his target. He gets up there, and the guy who had just parked the truck moments earlier is dead, and there's a bullet hole through the window, and he looks up, and like 50 yards away, there's a guy with a sniper rifle popped out of the sunroof of a car. How would he have not heard a sniper rifle? Now, a silencer on, say, a 9mm or 45, that cuts the decibel level down. I don't know what it's supposed to be, 20-25%, something like that. On a rifle, on a sniper rifle, you have any idea how loud those things are? What the military uses silencers for is it basically masks where the sound is coming from. That's the best use for it, because they're shooting from far, far away. And if you can mask, if you can lower the decibel levels, it can basically allow the echo to, you know, make it basically seem like you don't know where you are at all or where they're coming from and all that stuff. But yeah, it was a good show, actually. I recommend it. I'm about halfway through it now. I watched 4 or 5 episodes of the 8 that are out last night. But I mean, it sounds more exciting to have gone to a gun show. You know what I did this weekend? I cleaned the living room on Sunday. On Saturday, what did we do on Saturday? No, it was raining on Saturday, so we didn't do a whole lot of anything. We were just kind of home and doing stuff. My wife and son went out to the trampoline place yesterday while I was cleaning the house, cleaning the main floor of the house. A gun show is something that, like, I've always wanted to go to, but I just never have.
Yeah, well, because a lot of times it's hard to find. Well, it's not necessarily hard to find one. It's just you don't really think about it. And then for some reason, I've always found when I think about it and go to check, I just missed it. Like, it'll be the weekend prior to the one I want to go.
Yeah. Yeah. And there have been some before, like up when I was living in the Northeast before I moved down here, where I'd see a billboard as I was riding down the road or something like that, and just never ended up making it to them. Then again, there's a lot of things that I want to go to that I don't. Movies. I can't tell you the last time I went to a movie in the movie theater. Yeah. That wasn't a kid's movie.
Yeah.
Kids movies, I've been to a few, but other than that, just I don't get out as much. To events as I'd like to. It's all centered around my family now, and my 5-year-old did a gun show. That's a recipe for disaster. Don't need that happening, but certainly something that's interesting. And with the conversation that goes on about them, again, I have a lot of conversations with people who are like, oh, you were in the military, let's talk about guns. Oh, great. Okay, sure, let's do that. When they talk about gun shows, I can't really discuss that much because I've never been to one, so maybe I should check out one that's coming up.
They're interesting.
How often are they taking place around here? Pretty often, I would think.
Right? Yeah, there's two more happening this month from Showmasters. They're going to be happening in Richmond, which is about 100 miles away. So yeah, it's a bit far of a drive. But
it's not that far. However, I remember a time I was at Fort Meade for training and drove from Fort Meade down to Richmond to visit my buddy Wes. It took me 4.5 or 5 hours to get there. Yeah,
going down was fine. Coming back, traffic was horrible.
Yeah, that's that whole Beltway thing and that whole... I don't know. You know, I come down from the north into here, and I don't have to deal with too much traffic. But when I leave 20 minutes later than my normal time, oh, it gets ridiculous. And that I remember that drive down to Richmond. Thankfully, I had a new car that had what do you call it? GPS or not GPS? A satellite radio in it, so I was able to listen to the same radio shows all the way down and back. But yeah, that drive was, oh my God, it was a nightmare. I didn't move for 1 hour and 20 minutes. It was just sitting still. Like, all right, I guess I'll turn the car off and open up the windows. It was not a pleasant day. So Robert Wilkie, Jake, who is the acting VA secretary, has now been nominated to be the full-time VA secretary, where he will act like it because he is, I guess.
Right.
He won't be acting anymore. Well, our own Matt Sainsing reached out to Vote Vets to find out what they thought about that, because Vote Vets, as heard on this show, we had Will Fisher on. He's their director of government relations, and he talked about the reason for the lawsuit. This was in response to AmVets essentially saying, like, hey, we understand the reasoning behind the lawsuit, and it may have a legal leg to stand on, but we don't support it. We don't think it's in the best interest of veterans. As Will told us, like, well, you know what? What it is in the best interest of is America, is what he believes and they believe. And that's why, you know, they feel they need to stop the president from feeling like he can do anything that he wants to, because he didn't follow the normal protocol here. Of course, we had the discussion in the newsroom just last week when Wilkie was nominated about that lawsuit coming from Vote Vets and Democracy Forward and some other organizations as well. That, according to Jonathan Kopanger, who's worked at the VA and knows a little bit about, you know, processes for nomination and everything and has looked into it, that as long as someone has served in a position in the government for like a certain number of days, the president can appoint them to any other position in the government, essentially. So Jonathan was making the point that, like, he doesn't know if this lawsuit would even be legally valid because of that. But now Vote Vets is saying that Wilkie cannot be nominated to lead the agency while serving as acting secretary. They cite 5 USC 3345 parentheses B parentheses 1, and that bars a person from serving as an acting officer should the president nominate such person to the Senate for appointment to that office. So we talked to Fisher again. You can go and see the interview, or not the interview, the story that Matt wrote on the Secretary Wilkie lawsuit from Vote Vets. We wanted to call them up last week and ask them, you guys going to pull this lawsuit out now? Nope, doesn't appear so. It appears that they're dead set against it. And listen, they are not. And I had this discussion on social media after we had them on the show, where I tweeted out a picture of myself with Will and the link to the interview and all that stuff and where it came from, and said, you know, hey, you can check this out. You can check out the story. And I got people tweeting at me like, they're a political organization, not a VSO, and blah, blah, blah. And I said, yeah, they are. They're a political action committee. And guess what? They tell you that they're a political action community up front. It's what they do. I mean, there are people who are out there and just want to get angry about everything. Vote Vets is a very left-leaning political organization, just like Concerned Veterans for America is a very right-leaning veteran organization. And there's nothing wrong with that. You're allowed to do that. I don't agree with everything that either one of them says. I don't agree with most of what one of them says when I look at it that way. Almost all, you could say. So there are, you know, different, it's frustrating, you know, it's frustrating. And I understand some of the anger when people see something like this, where you have a veterans group that's doing something that say, a lot of people say is not in the best interest of veterans, yet they're still doing it for what a lot of people would say are political reasons. Yeah, I understand the frustration with that, but my God, man, when I start getting direct messages through Twitter telling me about how, like, you know, hey, I'm either a fascist or some super left-wing, what was it, you
Obama, were called the Obama Kool-Aid drinker. Butt-kissing Kool-Aid drinker.
I can't use the words that I've been called as far as the, particularly the, oh, you super left-wing, blah, blah, blah. You fill in whatever you want for blah, blah, blah. But the right-wing fascist, I get that one too. Can't be one or the other. I mean, you can't be both. So what is it? I mean, I could be one or the other. I'm not.
Yeah,
I'm not. I'm just me. I don't agree with everything that anybody does, but that's what it's gotten to at this point. And I don't like it, particularly within our community, where look at things like Brian Mast and Tulsi Gabbard getting together on berm pits and being able to work together despite political difference for the greater good. That's what it's all about. It's not about yelling at people. Oh, you talk to vote vets. Oh, you Kool-Aid drinking Obama sycophant. No, not necessarily. Oh, you talk to Dan Crenshaw, you super right-wing lunatic. Nope, also not that.
That's the problem with our political discourse these days, is that any hint at listening to the other side is tantamount to treason.
Yeah, it's really fascinating what's going on there. So it's irritating. And now that I see it, like, personally, I see both sides. The funny thing is, people on both sides will claim that it's just the other ones who are doing it.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's just them that does that. And then I'll see things, you know, I've stopped commenting. You know what I start doing on social media, like on Facebook, Jake? I'll see things that I want to comment on. Like on a friend's page, he posted something about the girl at Kent State who took the picture with her with the gun for her graduation. Did you see that?
Yeah.
He posted that and he was like, you know, this is great. She's exercising her freedoms and blah, blah, blah. And now people are threatening her life and that's not cool. Some of his friends were like, well, she deserves everything she's getting because she had to know what she was doing and blah, blah, blah. Basically saying, like, you did this, you deserve death threats. No, that's not okay. Death threats are not. They were also like, well, it's just harassment. I was like, yeah, threats against
just
your life
harassment.
Are a little bit more than harassment. But harassment is often criminal in and of itself. So what I do, and maybe people out there can take a page from my book on this one. I wrote like a 4-paragraph response to it yesterday after I finished cleaning. I'm sitting at home alone watching the Mets game. They won, swept the Diamondbacks, by the way. I wrote this 4-paragraph, 5-paragraph thing, you know, just firebombing all these people's opinions that would say, like, oh, she deserved it. And then my friend would comment and be like, wait, you're saying that she deserves death threats? No. But you just said she deserved it in the comment above that. I write my 4 or 5 paragraphs, just destroying them, just going scorched earth. And then you know what I do? I highlight it, I delete it, and I go to another page. I don't ever post it. I know I thought it, and boy, if they read it, they'd be, there's just no point. And especially for one like yesterday, I don't know these people. It was 2 ladies in particular who were both just being hypocrites and saying, like, well, no, she doesn't deserve death threats, but she deserves everything she's getting. Well, she's getting death threats. So if you're saying she deserves everything she's getting, then you're saying she deserves death threats. I stopped doing it. I stopped. And also one of them, see, what really got me started on is one of them while making what was not a point was making a stupid opposite of a point. That person said would of, not would of, W-O-U-L-D apostrophe V-E, the contraction of would and have, that's a word, would space O-F.
Oh, bad grammar.
Would of. Oh, and yeah, when people talk about grammar Nazis, guess what? Happy to be one, because there is no better way and no faster way for someone to discount your argument and look at you like a dum-dum than you using would of or could of instead of
well,
would
it's kind
have.
Of an ad hominem attack, man. It's like you're not attacking their point, you're attacking their grammar. Maybe they're we're journalists, man. We're trained in this stuff.
Yeah,
maybe
but
they're
here's
not.
The thing. If you're not smart enough to realize the difference between would of, which is gibberish nonsense, and would have, the contraction would have, you're not smart enough to have an opinion on anything. There are those people who will say that. And you know what? I kind of agree. Because some of these people, you're in your 30s and you still don't know the difference between would have and would of. Oh, boy. It's infuriating to me. That got me started on it. But yeah, we're just getting started here on this show. Melissa Bryant, IAVA Chief Policy Officer, coming on here in just a moment. We're going to talk about Robert Wilkie and oh, so much more taking place in the world of veterans. It's the Morning Briefing Monday edition. Back after this.
Helping military veterans stay connected.
We make it easy.
We are CBS Radio's ConnectingVets.com. Connecting vets every day.
Online and all over social media. Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter at Connecting Vets.
Welcome back to the Morning Briefing on Entercom Radio's ConnectingVets.com. Connecting Vets every day, it's our headline because it's what we do. We are looking at the veteran experience from top to bottom, inside and out, looking at legislative issues, looking at benefits available to you, looking at programs, looking at entertainment, looking at things that's just kind of cool. All of that is available on ConnectingVets.com. And also, the best way to be kept abreast of what we're doing on that website, follow us on social media. We are at Connecting Vets on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and, of course, YouTube. Our next guest is a veteran of the United States Army. She's also one of those important folks working over at Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. She is basically the person that you want to talk to about policy and legislation and anything from IAVA, Ms. Melissa Bryant. Melissa, how are you this morning?
I'm wonderful this morning. How are you doing?
Say that again.
I'm wonderful this morning. How are you doing?
And then a little bit closer to the microphone.
I'm wonderful this morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Little inside radio here. I just had to actually delete something out because, well, we pre-record some of these interviews. Breaking down the fourth wall there. That's my own fault. But, of course, Melissa, you are keeping an eye on everything that involves veterans when it comes to legislation and policy of the politicians in the Washington, D.C. area. And in other places around the country, because of course IAVA members are all around the country. There are hundreds of thousands of them paying attention on the national level and the local level. Of course, this week we've seen a ton of big national news as far as legislation. Let's start off with one that IAVA was instrumental in. There was a press conference that took place last week now with Congressman Mast and Congresswoman Gabbard about burn pit legislation, which is something that finally it looks like there's going to be some positive movement on. We've got two veterans working on that together in Congress. Tell us a little bit about this, the press conference, what they said there, and what we're looking at moving forward with this burn pit legislation.
We're so grateful to have Congresswoman Gabbard and Congressman Mast working on this, two prominent post-9/11 vets pushing for an issue that is so central to what I think every post-9/11 vet can relate to, and that's burn pits. I don't think anyone I've heard a story from doesn't know about a burn pit or doesn't talk about even the other airborne toxins or other nasty stuff that we all dealt with when we were downrange, or maybe even sometimes CONUS. And so the Burn Pits Accountability Act, what it does is it holds DOD accountable. What it does is start to track on the DOD side where you've been exposed, when you've been exposed, and making sure that data gets into the burn pit registry. And it's an opt-out of the registry rather than what it is now, and that's an opt-in to the VA's registry. So this is a really big step. It's an incremental step, and we know that, but it's a big step. It's critical toward moving to hopefully what we won't relive like our parents did with Agent Orange and our fathers and mothers who were exposed to Agent Orange in Vietnam. That was a 16-year fight to getting that to a presumptive illness that was given disability compensation. And so we want to make sure that we don't have to fight as long as our fathers did. We want to make sure that we're getting this through now and that we're tracking it now. Sadly, we're still there, especially in Afghanistan. We're still exposed. And so we want to make sure that DOD is held accountable for that.
When you talk about that 16 years, even longer than that, if you think about the Blue Water Navy mm-hmm. Agent Orange issues, which are still ongoing, there's legislation now working its way through that may finally address those who served on ships where they were you know, loading Agent Orange onto aircraft where there were plumes of it coming from the shore out to them in the ocean. They are still not receiving benefits, but we're finally seeing some movement on that. This burn pit legislation, recently announced, recently started. So, you know, when you look at it, and when you sit down and talk with the members of Congress that are involved, Mast, Gabbard, and the other folks who are working on it from your community and others, what's the timeline looking like? I mean, do you have a best case, worst case scenario for it?
Well, our best case scenario is getting this enacted into law this year. So right now we already have, as of its introduction, 5 co-sponsors. It's bipartisan. It's something that everyone we talk to is really behind. We have 24 veterans organizations who have now coalesced around this, to include those from like Vietnam Veterans of America and Burn Pits 360 and other folks who are really, you know, leading the charge on this and have looked at it for going back 50 years. And so with this movement that's moving forward, we think it has a really strong chance of being enacted into law. There's many ways in which we're looking to do that, through several must-pass bills, as well as looking at pushing this through as a standalone. But we see the movement, and that's the big thing, is that you have the right folks who are championing it at the right time, and we can really see this passing by the end of 2018. Worst case scenario, I don't even want to think about, because that would mean starting over. And anytime we have to start over, it's setting our entire generation back.
It absolutely is. And this is something that is certainly important for them to at least keep track of. I mean, there are, it seems obvious to any of us who ever saw a burn pit and ever heard of any of the things that were going in there. Just heard a story the other day of the 4th of July, some Marines throwing batteries in there as they would function as fireworks. So they would get a little bit of a sparkle coming out of there.
Marines will be Marines.
So it seems obvious to all of us that this would be an issue. There's still medical research being done on it. Again, people can opt into this list, whereas this would create it being automatic. It seems also obvious that it should be a no-brainer to get through and get approved by Congress, if that's really what this is about, is creating that registry that's automatic for those who were exposed to these things. What could keep it from happening? Is it cost? Is it going to be something that's rather expensive, or no?
No, that's the beauty of this bill, is that it's not low. It's not high cost. In fact, there's very low cost. It's a matter of using what's already there that's already being reported. It's using the periodic health assessments that everyone does annually. It's using the post-deployment health assessments. And then also, as you're separating through the transition assistance program, through all the services, it's checking those blocks at each one of those stoplights. Think of those as your stoplights going through where they're saying, where were you deployed? What could you have been exposed to? And as you're doing that, then it's starting to build that evidence, and it helps to be able to understand when you're a veteran and you've crossed over and you've taken off the uniform, to be able to show what you may or may not have been exposed to the VA. And this is something that really goes a long way in being able to, instead of you having to come in with a mountain of forms, right, which is currently the process, you know, to file that claim, you have that ammunition with you.
And that's what it's all about, setting up our veterans for success, even if it's a success in dealing with a medical issue, making sure that they're not behind the eight ball. And it makes me think back. I keep remembering when I was a kid talking to the VFW members in the area where I grew up who were in the first Gulf War, and the medical issues that some of them faced, the guys who were trying to cap off those burning oil wells that we remember from the Kuwaiti oil fields.
Right.
The Gulf War illness, as it was called, Gulf War syndrome, was something that it took a long time to get addressed, and in many cases is still kind of not been addressed. We keep having these repetitions of us not learning from previous mistakes. Do you think of this as us actually getting ahead of the game as compared to the issues that we've had in the past with Agent Orange and the Gulf War issues?
I think we're trying to get ahead of the game. I mean, the burn pits issue, the alarm was sounded years ago. I mean, this is really 10 years in the making, right? I think it was 2007 when people first started saying, this just doesn't seem right. Why is there a constant stench, constant, it felt actually like the air was heavy when you were, where I was serving in Iraq, and I know in Afghanistan, but you mix that with the dust particulates, and it was just a recipe for disaster. Mm-hmm. And so we're getting ahead of the curve, but only in the sense that we're 17 years into this. So sadly, when you compare that to Vietnam, where it took them 16 years after the Vietnam War ended to get this as a presumptive condition, and so we're kind of matching out around the same time frame, you know, at that point. So, but we are drawing upon those lessons learned. And just as we stand with our Vietnam brethren, you know, you mentioned the Blue Water Navy vets, you've mentioned, we already talked about Agent Orange and Gulf War syndrome. We stand with all of those who came before us, and now they're standing with us. And they're giving us their lessons learned. They're giving us their playbook and how we can move forward in this and really do something at this point. Because there's, like you said, the research and everything is great, but we know it's a problem. We just need to do something about it.
It is. And it's one of those things, like, as you said, the smell and the stench, it reminded me of, you know, being around an incinerator, being around something at a dump where they would burn, you know, the stuff that they wasn't going to, wasn't going to dissolve on its own. Essentially, the military was using it for even more than that. It was an all encompassing, like, what's that, paper?
Yep.
Throw it in there. Medical waste? Throw it in there. What is it? Throw it in. There was very little that they wouldn't throw in a burn pit while we were over there and while we still are over there in Afghanistan specifically. Something that certainly needs to be addressed in this new legislation coming from Congresswoman Gabbard, Congressman Mass, two Army veterans themselves, and of course with the backing of IAVA and many other veterans groups, hopefully will address it in the near future. As you said, you're hopeful this year. Let's hope. I mean, it seems, again, like a no-brainer. If it's not going to be expensive, it's going to help out the military and veterans, who's going to vote against it? That's the question that you have to have. Now, of course, some people chose to remove some veterans items from the omnibus spending bill when it went through recently. We've talked about this in the past. Well, for the political reasons in that, which we're not going to get into again, everybody knows why things were pulled out of there so that people could vote against the bill and not appear to be voting against veterans. The items that were pulled out have basically been included in the Mission Act and a couple other things that are now moving through with large support, just as they would have had in the omnibus spending bill. How is IAVA feeling about the changes that will come with the Mission Act, specifically to choice program and extending caregiver benefits to, while IAVA is Iraq and Afghanistan veterans of America, there are plenty that were injured beforehand, disabled for things that happened beforehand that aren't available or eligible for those benefits. So tell me IAVA's stance on the Mission Act.
We support the Mission Act. We stand with our brothers and sisters. We joined the letter of, I believe, 38 VSOs and MSOs who wanted to see the Mission Act go through. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. It is imperfect. And we still remain skeptical of the choice program. One of the reasons why we signed on to this bill is that this bill effectively sunsets choice and it consolidates all the community care programs. It allows for the expansion of caregivers, which we support for our pre-9/11 brethren. And so I think that there's a lot of goodness in this bill. And like all bills, it's wildly imperfect in many ways, but we want to remain skeptical, but yet optimistic and continue to work with lawmakers to make it, to implement it in the right way and work with the VA to implement it in the right way.
And it's going to cost $52 billion for all the things that are in there, and they don't have that money yet. So they all want it to go through. It's looking like, you know, it's going to be passed through. Everybody's going to be happy with it. It's leaning that way now. Until the president signs it, nothing is final. But if it does get through, then they need to find out where the money is going to come from. And, you know, that's the way it kind of works with legislation. That's that catch-22 there. But, you know, overall, it seems that it's got a lot of support in the veteran community, in the VSO community, even those who are skeptical of some things in it, like apparently IAVA is, which, hey, there's nothing wrong with a healthy amount of skepticism. Do you think that this is going to be a benefit in that we now, 3 months from now, won't have to hear, oh, they're going to shut down the funding for the VA and the choice program, blah, 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 blah. That's been a recurring theme here in Washington, D.C. Is that at least one of the benefits we can take away from this?
It is. You know, at least in that regard, it does take the pressure off. If this is, you know, if all goes well, the desired end state is for this to be signed into law by Memorial Day. And the president has said that that's what he would do if it makes it through the Senate by then. And so it alleviates that pressure. We are skeptical of, you know, how the choice program continues through this bill. It allows for $5.2 billion to the choice program so that other regulatory items can be established during that time frame. So it's bridge funding. And we're always skeptical of any expansion of something that is already problematic, as such as the choice program. But we're going to remain optimistic. We're going to stand with our brothers and sisters, and we're going to continue to work with the VA as they implement this. And hopefully this alleviates some pressure, but it's not a panacea.
We're speaking with Melissa Bryant. She's the Chief Policy Officer at Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Speaking of the VA, recent news, Robert Wilkie, who was the acting secretary of the VA, has now been nominated to be the full-time secretary of the VA. Of course, you guys are a VSO. You're not in the business of supporting or not supporting anybody. But of course, you do have your opinions on these things. hearing the name Robert Wilkie for VA secretary, I mean, how does IAVA feel about that?
Well, we haven't polled our members yet. You know that that's a hallmark of what IAVA does, is to pulse our membership and ask them, how do you feel about it? We did it with Secretary Shulkin. We did it with Ronnie Jackson when he was the nominee. And so we're probably going to do the same thing with under acting Secretary Wilkie. He does have some positives, I can say right now, in that he's obviously in the position, has been for the past 2 months or so since Secretary Shulkin was ousted. And he obviously comes in with a depth and breadth of knowledge from his position at DOD, where he was the Undersecretary for Personnel and Readiness. He himself knows the military community very well, and comes from military legacy family. He obviously understands the legislative side from his work with Tom Tillis's, with Tom Tillis, I should say. And so I know that he has a lot of right ingredients to work toward this, especially the piece that we harped on when Admiral Jackson was the nominee, and that's the bureaucratic management experience. That's understanding a large organization like no other. And so if you can figure out the puzzle palace at the Pentagon, then you can hopefully figure out the VA too.
Robert Wilkie, of course, as you mentioned, from an Army family. His father retired as Lieutenant Colonel from the United States Army. That's Robert Wilkie Sr., who passed away last year. He was born in Frankfort. He was born in a military installation, grew up mostly on Fort Bragg. So this is someone who's intimately familiar with the military. That's one of the things that people say they want to look for in a VA secretary. So he's certainly got that. He's got a lot of the government experience, as you mentioned, being involved in DOD. So I think at least in those aspects, as you said, kind of a positive in those two things. What are his feelings on everything that the VA does and on the choice program and all the things that, you know, are somewhat controversial with different groups looking at them different ways? I mean, we had Vote Vets in here a couple weeks ago talking about their lawsuit to remove Wilkie as the acting VA secretary, which, you know, one of the things I asked him is, hey, what if he gets promoted to full time? What do you do then? They kind of said, we're going to see the lawsuit through to the end no matter what. So, you know, there are people who will not be happy about this. Right. There are people that will be happy about this. Have you gotten any feeling yet in his time as acting secretary over the last, what, month, 2 months or so, on what type of person he is and how he feels about the veteran community and what the VA is doing?
I can say that I personally have participated in roundtables with the acting secretary. First, when he was undersecretary at the Pentagon, I participated in a roundtable earlier this year where we found him very level-headed, very passionate for the military community, really understanding of what was needed, especially in his capacity and understanding personnel and readiness. And obviously readiness is the number one priority of SecDef right now. On the VA side, he also, within his first couple of weeks of being in that position, invited the veteran service organizations over and, you know, had the large groups, and not limited to the Big Six, but had several groups in to talk about priorities, talk about next steps. At the time, there were a lot of unknowns. There was uncertainty of whether he would be the nominee or anyone else. In fact, he didn't even put that out there. But he was welcoming, and that I can appreciate. That I can appreciate on behalf of IAVA's membership, and that we were in that room and at the table and able to converse with him and share what our top priorities were, burn pits being one of them, which I hope he can also appreciate from coming from the DOD side of things and from coming from Fort Bragg.
He's also, as we mentioned, the son of a career Army man. His father, a lieutenant colonel, passed away in 2017 at the age of 79. So this is someone who's probably, via his father's interactions, quite familiar with how things work at the VA from the family perspective anyway. I mean, I would imagine, particularly considering that he worked in DOD at the time and everything, he would have been involved in what his father was going through and any VA mm-hmm. care that he received. So that could be a positive as well, couldn't it?
It could be. It could be. And I mean, I think by and large, the biggest reservation that folks had over Admiral Jackson was the fact that he lacked the management experience, that he did not understand running a large, or I should say he didn't understand, but he did not have the experience in running a large organization like the VA. And so I think the biggest plus mark in the plus column, rather, for Mr. Wilkie is that he will have that experience coming out of the Pentagon.
Mm. He's also a lawyer by trade. He has his JD from Loyola University in New Orleans, has his master's of judicial, blah, 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 that whole
he's
thing.
He's incredibly
Georgetown,
smart.
Georgetown, you know, U.S. Army War College. He has his master's from
he's
there.
He's a 400-pound brain, as we would say in the Army.
Hey, and that can be a good thing. And with some of the issues that we have at the VA, that might be kind of what we need over there. I mean, some of these same mistakes and same issues that keep on coming up and keep plaguing the VA that would seem to be eminently fixable. And a lot of people involved in that job, a lot of people sitting in that job who haven't quite been able to get that done. So maybe someone with that kind of experience is what we need in that position.
One would hope. I mean, again, I think IAVA is going to want to pulse our membership. We're going to want to understand more of what they want to see. I think I've talked about the pillars of what we look for before. Out of our last poll, the top three issues that people look for was healthcare experience, management experience, and veteran experience, military experience. And so he checks two of the three again, which seems to be the combination. We seem to never get all three, but I don't know if all three really exist out there. And so I think that he definitely has a good shot at being successful. We hope that he continues to seek the advice and counsel of the VSOs, because that's what we're here for, is to provide them that advice and counsel and give them the pulse of our community. And really the big thing that has plagued the VA has been not having someone who can be steady at the helm. And that's what they need, is that someone who can just keep things calm and right the ship. And right now it's rudderless. And I think that he can be, if he can just keep that calm, he'll be successful there.
Now, of course, IAVA is going to pull their membership, because that's how you guys figure out what the membership feels about everything. You don't just assume that they feel one way or another. You actually go out and ask them. And we're speaking with IAVA's Chief Policy Officer, Melissa Bryant, Army veteran herself. There are going to be people who say they don't like Robert Wilkie for one reason, and that reason is, well, he was nominated by President Trump. And there are people who don't believe that President Trump is capable of doing anything that is not just the worst possible decision. There will be people who answer that way because of that. Speaking of President Trump, just recently learned that he was going to donate his first quarter salary of 2018 to the Department of Veterans Affairs. So that is $100,000, which, by the way, $400,000, along with the free house, along with the cars driving everybody there, the basically servants everywhere you go, they're taking care of you. Certainly seems like a pretty good gig, although the stress and that we see everyone who goes in when they leave 4 or 8 years later looks about 50 years older. So there are drawbacks. But, hearing that he's going to do that, this $100,000, which, okay, $100,000 is a drop in the bucket when it comes to the caregiver programs. But just seeing him being able and willing to do that, how does IAVA feel about that? I mean, that's a pretty cool thing that he's doing, I think.
Well, we don't have a position on that per se, but I mean, I think it's symbolic. Yeah. I think it's symbolic of him being able to support and literally put his money where his mouth is, and to contribute to an issue that is near and dear to the veteran community. So we don't have an official position on that, but it's symbolic.
Yeah. And that may be all that it is, but I mean, it's a symbolic gesture that's not been made by any president before. So that's an interesting thing. And of course, when you get into politics, and particularly when you talk about that guy, there are going to be people who love everything he does, hate everything he does. And then those sitting in the middle like me who are like, some things are okay, some things not so okay. So,
Then what you just said right there is how IAVA's membership pretty much falls. Yeah. And so, I mean, every time we pulse our members, it's, this is okay, that's not okay. And so that's the post 9/11 generation, I think.
I think it is. And I think the polls that we've seen of, Military Times did a poll of the military. They have access to the ability to do that, where his support in the active duty military tends to be a little bit higher than it is in the general population. And not like he's got 90% approval ratings in the military, but it tends to be more like, some people think like, some of what he's doing is good, some of what he's doing is not so good. It does seem that the military is able to take a little bit more of an even-handed approach towards that. Well, we've been speaking with Melissa Bryant. She is Chief Policy Officer at IAVA, Army veteran, Operation Iraqi Freedom. And of course, those polls and everything else basically emanate from the IAVA website to the membership and people signing up. So IAVA is a free membership VSO. Everyone who's eligible is able to join free of cost. Where do they go if they want to find out more about what it means to join and what they can do to join and how they can get involved, and also to find out about the great things that you and your team are doing when it comes to policy and legislation?
Absolutely. Go to IAVA.org, and there's tons of drop downs there. But when you go there, you'll see a button for how to join. You'll see IAVA in Washington. You'll see all the great work that my office does here out of D.C. And you'll also see links to the socials. So please follow us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook. That really is the key, the linchpin to reaching our community. The post 9/11 generation, as you know, we're very much into the social media cycle. And so check us out on Twitter. You'll get the links to everything we've done, to include our Burn Pits presser last week.
Yeah. And there's been a lot going on there. I mean, there was just last week, there was a press conference with Mast and Gabbard there, and IAVA was there. Paul, of course, the founder of IAVA. Quick question for you as we finish up. I'm going to put you on the spot. Not an IAVA member. Tell me why I should. What's it going to do for me to become an IAVA member?
It is always good to connect with your fellow brethren. And so I think that when you become an IAVA member, you talk to people who understand the issues the way that we uniquely process them in our generation. You and I just talked about how we fall in the middle. We see some things great, some things bad, but it's good to be able to commune with other people who see things the way that we do. We're not a monolithic community. And so we have our virtual veterans hall through IAVA. Again, it's free. You sign up, you're able to readily connect with folks. And then we have vet togethers that happen throughout nationwide, where local leaders stand up and say, hey, let's go hit up a game. Let's go hit up the bar. Let's do whatever we want to do, to where we come together as a community. And it's not quite in a formulaic way in which we do it. And so I think that that's the unique benefit you get from joining IAVA, and why I was a member before I was staff.
Well, there you go. You heard it right there from someone who went the membership way and then ended up working for the organization. Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. You can find them at IAVA.org. You're listening to The Morning Briefing on Entercom Radio's ConnectingVets.com. Stick around. More of the show to come after this.
Helping military veterans stay connected.
We make it easy.
We're CBS Radio's ConnectingVets.com. Connecting Vets every day.
Online and all over social media. Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter. At Connecting Vets.
Welcome back to The Morning Briefing here at Entercom's ConnectingVets.com. Connecting Vets every day. That's in our slogan because it's what we do, and we do it through a variety of platforms. Of course, we have the website, which has stories, audio, video, and social media. We are at Connecting Vets on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Little click on your mouse, little tap on your phone, and you are going to be living your best veteran life, getting the information that you need to know, the information that you should know, and some information that you might want to know. Like my story from a couple days ago about Monsters Among Us, veteran serial killers. Did you know that Jeffrey Dahmer served in the United States Army? And get ready for this. Creepiest part, he was a medic. There are people who probably had their blood drawn by Jeffrey Dahmer before he started killing people. Yeah, let that rattle around inside your head for just a moment. So give us a follow at Connecting Vets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. That's the best way to be kept up to date on what we're doing. And of course, at least 10, 15 times a day, go check out ConnectingVets.com, where you're going to find us talking to an amazing variety of veterans doing an amazing variety of things, including our next guest. His name is Chris White, and he is the CEO of Freedom Hard. Chris, good morning, and welcome to The Morning Briefing. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Still doing well after I told you about Jeffrey Dahmer being a medic in the Army?
I'm not so sure how to receive that, actually.
That's some new information for me and a lot of people. Now, let's give people some information on you. Who is Chris White? Where are you from? When did you join? And what did you do while you were in?
So I'm a Houston, Texas born and raised out here in Texas. I joined the Marines back in 2004 and just did my 4 years and got out. So I got out January 2008. I was always in the right place at the wrong time for my military service. My military occupational specialty was traffic management, but I never really ended up doing it. Basically, when I went overseas to go to Okinawa, Japan, I got attached to a whole bunch of different detail stuff that was happening, just being in the right place at the wrong time. And I did anything from auxiliary security forces, basically a support function to back up the military police in the event of like a riot would happen, to customs and immigration safety. And then I went and got stationed over in Paris Island for my last year and a half, and when I checked in, I didn't really have much experience doing my MOS, and so they basically put me doing other detail stuff over in Paris Island, so where I would go back and forth and teaching Marines on how to shoot different weapons on the rifle range and stuff like that.
Wow. So really a varied career. And one of those things that we hear from a lot of people who served that joined up to do one thing, get their MOS or their rating, whatever the case may be, and then end up kind of doing a variety of other things and never really working within their job. Sounds like that was the case with you. Think back to the time after those 4 years come to an end, your transition from the Marine Corps to the veteran world to civilian life. What was that like for you? What do you remember most about that period of time?
Very, very different from anyone that I've ever met in terms of comparing or contrasting my experience to theirs. So, you know, when I left South Carolina, I remember driving back to Texas, literally only knowing one thing about what my future was, and that was I was going to do anything but go back into the Marine Corps again. And so I had not a clue as to what, you know, what was in front of me, what I was going to do. So I went back to Texas and had not a clue about the veteran community or a support system or even the VA or anything like that. I didn't know anything like that. And so I did what pretty much 50% of, probably anyone leaving the service that comes back to the state of Texas, especially Houston, is you basically go into the medical field or you go into the energy industry. And so, since we're both the medical and the oil capital of the world, that's pretty much your two biggest platforms to find yourself in. So I continued doing my education, and I found myself working in the oil field basically as I was continuing my undergrad, and then starting my career within the energy industry over here until I finished my MBA. It wasn't until after I finished my MBA tour, actually, I started getting involved into the veteran community and actually discovering what the veteran community was all about. And ironically enough, Houston is known as the number two city across the entire United States for having such a dominant presence within the veteran community.
Wow. And that's really interesting stuff. And it's often the case, it seems, that those who serve sometimes need a little bit of break from being around those people that they served with, where it might take a couple of years before they want to, I don't know, maybe join a VSO like the Legion, the VFW, AM Vets or something like that, or just get involved with the veteran charities that are out there and the things that they're doing. Is that kind of how it was for you? Did you need, after 4 years of being a hard charging gung-ho Marine, did you need a little bit of separation from that military time when you got out?
I don't know if it was a matter of need or just found myself separated from the environment as a whole. I just was focused on myself and my career for a good 6-7 years or so, and just focused on that and didn't really have anything else that came into the picture, whether you labeled it as a distraction or anything like that. I mean, I just focused on myself and really just kind of, moved full speed ahead to do some of the things that I wanted to do before I started to get involved. I guess it was kind of by accident, attending some luncheons, and started to figure out, oh, there's a whole bunch of Marine veterans out there. I didn't even call myself a veteran for quite some time, actually. In fact, that was a term that was what I perceived as, if you called yourself a veteran, I was thinking Vietnam era, before I called myself a veteran, something like that.
Right.
So it took some time for me to get familiar with some of the language and the fact that there's literally another version of me and my counterparts right around the corner from just about every corner in Houston, you know?
Yeah, and really a variety of the veteran population that includes the Vietnam vets, the Korean vets, the World War II vets who've gone through everything that we've gone through just decades earlier that are really a great place for you to be able to draw information and experience from. We're speaking with Chris White, former Marine and current CEO of Freedom Hard. Now, Chris, when you think back on that time and you think back of any difficulties that you had, any struggles that you had, if there is, you know, a young Marine, soldier, sailor, airman, coastie who's finishing up their first tour and deciding to get out, what's the biggest piece of advice you think you could give them about preparing to move into the civilian world?
My biggest piece of advice would be something along the lines of, don't think that you have to find your next step within your career right away. It's okay to take some time to figure it out. I went through quite a bit of time on my own, just going through your typical trial and error, figuring mostly what I did not want to do versus what it was that I wanted to do. I had to make a couple of wrong turns along the way and say, okay, this is not for me. This is definitely what I don't want to do. And that's okay. I guess it's too easy to be discouraged by, going through two or three iterations of those and figuring out, man, I'm just struggling too much and I miss the military life too much. Well, that's not necessarily the case. So many of us go through so many of those wrong turns just to figure out what it is that we don't want to do. And just, that's just a part of life sometimes. And it was definitely a part of my, my history and my path, just to figure out what it is that you don't want to do. And so my biggest piece of advice would be like something along the lines of saying, look, you don't have to figure out what your next step is right away. It's okay to take some time to figure that out.
Certainly good advice there, that, you know, there is no rush. And I know it seems like a lot of people, after spending, you know, maybe 4 years in the Marine Corps, the Army, the Navy, they get out and they feel like they're behind the eight ball, you know, that they're somehow behind those who went directly into college. And we've been talking about this over the last, well, several months, about how you kind of gain things in the military that can be useful for you in the civilian world that somebody went straight into college out of high school and doesn't have. Is that something you'd agree with?
Oh, yeah, I would agree with that for sure. You know, when I got out, most of my peers that I knew from, you know, high school, I guess, were already either finishing up their undergrad or getting close to finish even their master's degree. And I'm thinking, oh, boy, I'm only just around the corner from my associates at this time. I better, you know, double down and figure out how to cross that finish line much faster than my previous pace was to catch up to them. But, you know, it's a different path. You come from a different path, and whether you collide with them to being on par with them down the road or not, I mean, it's really irrelevant. And we get caught up too much trying to compare ourselves to our peers when you've already differentiated yourself from your peers a long time before them, whenever you decided to sign on that dotted line. So it's too easy to get caught up on trying to play catch up for wherever your previous peers are in time, whenever you turn in your uniform, you know?
Well, and it sounds like you've caught up pretty well. I mean, you were just telling us about earning your MBA. And of course, as I've mentioned, Chris White is the CEO of Freedom Hard. So Chris, tell us about the journey to Freedom Hard and where that really began in earnest and how you got to where you are now with the company.
Yeah, it basically is a byproduct of how I was able to turn some negative experiences into some significant motivation. So 2016, for me personally, came to a crashing halt. Let's see, November 17th, 2016, I was basically stabbed in the back by my business partner at the time, which was 6 weeks before I was supposed to get married. And 30 hours before I was supposed to get married, my fiance and her two kids decided to leave Texas and drive back to South Carolina because she decided she didn't want to get married. And so there I was, pretty much in one of my darkest hours, figuring out, okay, life isn't really turning out to be the way that I thought it was supposed to be with my current situation. And so I basically ran away to Mexico on a one-way ticket, spent just under 2 weeks there, came back, and then I spent about 6 weeks drinking all the alcohol from the wedding that I paid for that never took place. And one buddy of mine said, Chris, you need to pull your head out of your ass, basically. You know, I think you should get into marketing. And I don't come from a marketing background, and I didn't really know what he meant by that, but I kind of sat on it for about 3 or 4 days. And one night, February 28th last year, I was in front of my computer and I said, okay, I'm going to create a brand. And that brand is now known as Freedom Hard.
And tell the people who don't know what Freedom Hard is exactly what you guys are about, because there are a lot of veteran-owned companies out there who seem to be very specialized that focus on one thing. Freedom Hard seems to be dipping some toes in quite a few pools.
Oh, absolutely. So while people say the word competitor, these guys aren't really my competitors, and I'll explain why. So Freedom Hard is not known as a product. You know, we don't specialize in a product. We have a bunch of products, but Freedom Hard will always be known as a brand. It's a brand that stands for using humor as a platform to display patriotism. And so why humor is because humor is very therapeutic. It's a coping mechanism that anyone can use to at least get through whatever struggles they might be going through. It doesn't matter if you're a veteran, it doesn't matter if you're a civilian or not, whether you suffer from post-traumatic stress, isolation, loneliness, family issues, drug overdose, alcoholism, it doesn't matter. If I can make you laugh for 5-10 minutes at least for that 5-10 minutes, your mind is in a better place than in whatever dark hole you might have found yourself into being. And if I can use that by also gearing it towards using it to display patriotism, then to me it's the ultimate win-win. So a lot of the brand content that you might find on social media, for example, is usually something that's very hilarious, right? It'll be something that makes you laugh, but it's also very patriotic in nature. Along the way, we've also commercialized some products, anything from any kind of apparel items to cigars, coffee, beard oil, and then we're about 2 weeks out from commercializing our own whiskey line as well.
Oh, wow. So really getting involved in all sorts of aspects of the business world. What's been the biggest hurdle for you as coming into this? As you said, you have your MBA, you did the schoolwork, then you actually get involved in starting this company kind of on your own. What's been the biggest hurdle for you? What was the most difficult part of starting Freedom Heart?
I think the starting point itself was the hardest point. So my background is I'm very used to working in corporate America. So I climbed the corporate ladder all the way from the ground level to senior management through executive, managing multimillion dollar budgets, being in charge of an entire department of 41 people, where it's if the way that you wanted to look at that was something very mature that I then became in charge of. So I didn't really have to create something from the ground up for me to own, as opposed to Freedom Heart. There was literally nothing whenever I said, okay, I'm now going to step into the realm of being an entrepreneur and I'm going to create something from absolutely nothing. I always found myself in a position landing into something that already created, and then I was in a position to make it a little bit more efficient and better. But for whenever I started Freedom Heart, there was nothing that existed, literally nothing at all, and I had to build it from the ground up. And so it's a lot of risk. It's a significant amount of risk because I put my heart and soul into it and a whole bunch of other things as well. So there was nothing that I could shape and then start to tell people this is what I'm trying to do. I mean, I'm literally holding my hands up and there's nothing there whenever I started February 28th last year. And so, you know, taking on the lifestyle of an entrepreneur, building something from the ground up, you really have a whole bunch of naysayers. You have a whole bunch of people say, you know, this, I don't know, you know, you're trying to enter a saturated market. I don't see how this is going to be successful. So you not only have to start something from nothing, you actually don't really have too much support in your corner as well whenever you embark on this new venture, you know.
Absolutely. And that is something that we've heard from several veteran entrepreneurs who've gone out there and started things on their own. And in some cases have actually had fits and starts. You know, they tried something and it didn't work out. They had to adapt and overcome, go back to the drawing board. What would you say your experience has been with Freedom Heart? I mean, have you been pretty lucky since starting it, or have there been those kind of, you know, big roadblocks that you needed to figure out a way around?
Oh, absolutely. It's the best and the worst of both worlds, actually. So there's been some partnerships in the beginning that I looked at them like, oh, wow, this is great. I'm already getting this opportunity. And then it turned out to not be a good fit for whatever reason. And that's both good and bad on my part, good and bad on their part as well. It just, for whatever reason, didn't work out. And then I've been very fortunate to be in the right place at the right time to where I'm already in a position with less than 1 year after being incorporated to where I have, my own coffee line, my own cigar line, and we're 2 weeks out from having my own whiskey line. And whenever I have these type of conversations with other people, they're thinking, wait, you only incorporated how long ago? And it, you know, when they hear that it's been less than a year and they're like, holy crap, this is incredible. How are you already up to this level already? And so, it's not all, you know, positive things. It's a whole bunch of negative experiences that we had to go through, a whole bunch of lessons learned, best practices. There were some bridges that had to be burned, of course. And then that's also a credit to being able to adapt and overcome. Being able to manage change is probably the biggest component of everything that's kind of led up to this point. So, it's not all unicorns and nice roses, basically, along the way. I mean, from someone to look at the brand and look through the lenses of just what you see on social media, you might think that, but behind the scenes, it's way more complex than that.
It certainly is, and that's certainly something, you know, I hear you talking about the ability to adapt to change, the ability to figure that out. How important do you think your ability to draw on your time in the Marine Corps has been in functioning as a CEO and looking at things like that? I mean, every Marine, every sailor, soldier, airman knows you have a plan, and then the first thing that happens when you make contact with any opposition is that plan goes completely into the trash. So how much do you draw on your military experience, do you think, in your position as CEO?
It's 100%, not 99.9. It's 100%. And I'll tell you this, I was not known to be somebody to, one, join the military, or two, even go to college before I went into the Marines. In fact, whenever I told everybody I'm joining the military, the Marines of all branches, everyone didn't even take me seriously. They're like, yeah, right, whatever. And then I was on record numerous times before then saying, I'm not the guy that's going to go to college. And then now I have an MBA. All this is credit to my time in the Marines, and the answer is basically because of this. Whenever I said, okay, I'm going into the Marines, that was the epitome of me stepping 100% out of my comfort zone. And so now I find myself more and more often living outside of the realm which you would label as my comfort zone, and I'm becoming more and more comfortable doing it. So I have to credit 100% of that to me joining the Marines, because that was the first step of me finding a way to step out of my comfort zone and being okay with it.
We're speaking with Chris White. Chris served in the United States Marine Corps, now serves as the CEO of Freedom Hard, a relatively new brand that's expanded in great ways since it started, and rather quickly. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Chris, is the fact that you guys are tied to several charities. In fact, you give a dollar from every bag of coffee that you sell to a nonprofit organization, which, you know, that's fantastic, and that's something that I certainly support. But from a business standpoint, particularly as a new company, how important was it to you to be associated with those nonprofits, to know that you're giving, you know, some of your profit to them?
It's extremely important, and I'll tell you the reasoning why. And it's because, you know, the number two commodity in the world right now is coffee, and that's number two next to only oil. So considering how many people out there that drink coffee, you then have to take into consideration how many coffee companies are out there, and there's an endless amount of us. And then it's even more complicated than that. The consumer is very loyal to the types of coffee that they actually drink. It's very hard to get someone to change their mind on that. And so you take that and you put it on the back burner, and you think, okay, I've now stumbled across a potential business opportunity for me to get into the coffee arena. And I thought, okay, I can't just stand on my coffee table and wave my arms in the air and say, hey, Freedom Hard now has coffee, come try it. It's not going to be good enough. And so I always had to find a way to make my business model extremely unique, but also impactful enough to where people can hear about Freedom Hard coffee and want to take the risk of, you know, basically avoiding whoever they're loyal to in terms of their coffee company before me. So the idea came up with, you know, I could partner with these nonprofits, and then I could allow them to receive a dollar per bag of coffee that's allowed by the consumer. So for the consumer to go to freedomhard.com, you get the selection, not me. It's not me that says, hey, $1 per every bag of coffee goes to this nonprofit. You get the selection, the flexibility of identifying which nonprofit you want the $1 to go to, which is kind of unheard of. But also the other side of the coin is I allow these six nonprofit organizations to help me market the product, right? So if I strategically place them all over the United States by vetting them first, then everybody helps me market the product, and then I become six people all at once.
Wow, really, a lot goes into this, and that's why you've got your MBA, Chris White, CEO of Freedom Hard, a Marine who has moved into really a bunch of businesses here, all wrapped into one, dealing with coffee, dealing with apparel, dealing with cigars, and you just mentioned whiskey is soon to come for you. So what is the future of Freedom Hard? You've had so much success with Freedom Hard in such a relatively short period of time. Where do you see things going from here, and do you have anything that's on the horizon that you can tell us about?
Absolutely. So the future is definitely bright for Freedom Hard, and it comes in kind of twofold. One is the more important reason, which I'll label it as this. I want Freedom Heart to be known as the brand that reinvigorated patriotism for America. And if you look at those words that I chose them very carefully. And nowhere in that statement did I say something about becoming a $100 million organization or selling a whole bunch of products. If my brand is recognized in 5-10 years from now as the brand that reinvigorated patriotism, that is the ultimate holy grail for me. That means I would gladly take that and sacrifice anybody buying any of our products, because that's not what we're about. We are a brand, not a product. And so in doing that, we have to get the brand out there. By doing that, you have to, you know, dish out products, commercialize new ones. And so what's on the horizon for Freedom Heart is we're going to be opening up a whole bunch of brick and mortars, but it's not just going to be your typical company that you see in like a strip center or something like that. What we want to do is open up coffee, whiskey, and cigar lounges to where if you are a patriot, it doesn't matter if you're a veteran or not, but if you're a patriot, you support patriotism, you support the Constitution, you support veterans, military, first responders, you can come into this establishment and hang out and feel a sense of pride within your country and also relax a bit and share some war stories, share some cool ideas and sit around and lounge basically while we have some cool products that you can partake in, like smoking some cool cigars, drinking some whiskey or drinking coffee, but then you can also purchase some apparel items as well.
You know, it's one of those things that we've talked to people about, and putting together a space where people can come together, veterans and patriots and everyone else, that can often be the biggest thing, just getting those people in a room together. And it sounds like that is what the plan is for Chris White, former Marine, current CEO of Freedom Heart. Now, Chris, if people are interested in finding out more about Freedom Heart, where can they go? Are you guys on social media? You got a website? Tell us where to go to find out more about the brand.
Oh, absolutely. Just about any social media platform, if you just type in Freedom Heart, you'll see the logos pop up there. But anyone can also go get a pretty good, solid understanding if they just go to freedomheart.com.
All right, and there you go. We are done.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app. Oh,